Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the September 20th, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week has a bright orangish-red background and Donald Trump in the foreground in his traditional blue suit, red tie. He's got both hands raised. He looks agitated. He's saying something or yelling at somebody. But in place of the top of his head looks like a nuclear explosion. The classic mushroom cloud in yellow and white with a ring cloud coming up around it. The headline is Triggered. Will Trump's debate meltdown cost him the election? That is our first main story, and we will start right there. Harris puts agitated Trump on ropes in debate. What happened? Kamala Harris was widely credited this week with dominating Donald Trump in their first presidential debate, in which she calmly needled and increasingly rattled Trump about everything from his felony convictions to the crowd sizes at his rallies. In the ABC News face-off, Trump attacked Vice President Harris for the Biden administration's record on inflation and border security, and for backing away from progressive positions she championed in 2019, such as a ban on fracking. But the Republicans spent much of the debate, a crucial showcase for two candidates deadlocked in national polls, on the defensive as Harris belittled him as narcissistic and weak. She branded the former president's plan to hike tariffs on imported goods as a Trump sales tax that would hit the middle class, and told him that Russian dictator Vladimir Putin would eat you for lunch and that U.S. military leaders, some of whom worked for you, had called him a disgrace. And the Democrat taunted him about being fired by 81 million people in the 2020 election. Clearly, Harris said, he's having a very difficult time processing that. As he pushed back with mounting anger, Trump made numerous false assertions, several of which were corrected by moderators David Muir and Lindsay Davis. He repeated bogus social media claims that Haitian migrants in Springfield, Ohio, are consuming residents' pets. They're eating the dogs, he said. They're eating the cats. He said Democrats widely support executing babies after they're born, and that Harris wants to do transgender operations on illegal aliens that are in prison. Trump painted a bleak portrait of the U.S. as a dying nation under assault from violent migrants. Our country is being lost, he said. Afterward, Trump claimed victory in an unusual visit to the press spin room and called the morning show Fox and Friends. He said moderators rigged the debate by fact-checking him and not Harris, and suggested ABC should have its broadcast license revoked. But in a CNN snap poll, viewers declared Harris the winner by roughly 2-1, and even Trump's backers conceded defeat. Senator Lindsey Graham called the debate a disaster and a missed opportunity to negatively define Harris for voters. Fox News analyst Britt Hume called it a bad night for Trump, lamenting that he'd ignored advisors' pleas to stay on message and rose to the bait repeatedly. What the editorial said. Harris clearly won the debate, said the Wall Street Journal, but it's not because she made a powerful case for her candidacy. She sailed along on gauzy promises that she would help America chart a course to the future. Trump had a prime opportunity to pin her down on policies like her plan to raise taxes by $5 trillion, but he played into Harris' hands by diving down rabbit holes of personal grievance and vanity that hold little interest for voters worried about the price of groceries. Backed into a corner, Trump did what he always does, said the Miami Herald, spew misinformation. He reiterated his lie that he'd won the 2020 election and claimed every legal scholar supported the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Then there's the dog eating. It's surreal that a presidential candidate would spout this xenophobic and dehumanizing rumor. But here we are. We can only hope that for the swing voters watching, the truth hasn't become irrelevant. What the columnist said. Harris beat Trump at his own game, said Eugene Daniels in Politico. Dominance. For decades, his key strategy has been keeping his foes off kilter and forcing them to fight on his terms. But from the moment Harris strode to Trump's lectern to force a reluctant handshake, there was a dominant presence on stage, and it sure wasn't Trump. For the next 90 minutes, the ultimate alpha male withered in the presence of an alpha female with a plan to take him on. Harris cracked the code, said Peter Winter in The Atlantic. Feral and unrestrained by norms, Trump is hard to debate. But she understood that the key to defeating him is to trigger him psychologically. Her taunts tripped up Trump on the worst possible terrain for him. Over the course of the debate, he defended inviting the Taliban to Camp David and the mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6. He couldn't bring himself to say he wanted Ukraine to defeat Russia. Sputtering in outrage, Trump was like a dying supernova, shrinking before our eyes. The real loser was ABC News, said Liz Peek in FoxNews.com. Muir and Davis embarrassed themselves with their blatant favoritism, correcting Trump while letting Harris repeatedly dodge questions, like whether Americans are better or worse off than 4 years ago. Such howling about basic fact-checking is pathetic, said Jonathan B. Last in The Bulwark. The moderators let countless Trump lies slide, but calmly corrected whoppers like Trump's claim that he'd won the 2020 election. Good for them. Their job is not to be fair. It's to give their audience an accurate view of reality. Harris romped, said Susan B. Glasser in The New Yorker. But will it matter? New polling suggests Harris' remarkable honeymoon may be ending. A New York Times Siena poll released days before the debate put Trump up nationally 48% to 47%, and surveys from battleground states show nearly all are in a dead heat. Perhaps there are no undecided voters left in this bitterly divided nation, but one would hope a drubbing like the one Trump received might nudge the needle. The stakes, as the former president himself has emphasized repeatedly in recent days, could not be higher. And the controversy of the week. Trump, what to make of his economic plan? If you liked Donald Trump's economic policies the first time around, you're going to love Trumponomics 2.0, said Andrew Ross Sorkin in the New York Times. The Republican nominee set out his fiscal agenda in a speech to the New York Economic Club last week. And his vision can be boiled down to higher tariffs, lower taxes, and more Elon Musk. By deputizing the world's wealthiest man to head a government efficiency commission, Trump expects to cut trillions in wasteful government spending. Never mind that SpaceX, Musk's rocket company, is a major government contractor. Trump says he'll also juice the economy by slashing the corporate tax rate from 21% to 15%, but only for companies that make their products in the U.S. As for tariffs, Trump is more convinced than ever that taxing imports is the one weird trick that can balance the budget, fund pet projects, and bring U.S. jobs back from overseas, said Neil Irwin in Axios. He wants a 10% tariff on all imports and 60% on imports from China. Yet those taxes would raise only $225 billion a year in revenue, barely denting our $1.7 trillion deficit. And most economists agree that they would also fuel inflation, choke growth, and trigger inevitable retaliation from our trading partners that would raise prices even higher for struggling U.S. consumers. Liberal economists can make whatever claims they want, said Liz Peek in The Hill. But if Trump's policies are so terrible, why do so many people think they were better off during his presidency? And why do voters consistently tell pollsters that they'll do better under Trump than under Kamala Harris? Tariffs are bad, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, but unleashing Musk on government is an excellent idea. The federal Leviathan is in desperate need of reform, and Musk, whose SpaceX has shown the private sector can outperform NASA, is just the man to do it. He could yield massive savings from programs that run on autopilot, from federal job training to Pentagon procurement. Crusading against waste may be a clever gambit politically, said Matthew Iglesias in Bloomberg, but it won't deliver the country to budget nirvana. Of the five priciest items on the federal balance sheet, three are social services for the infirm or elderly, one is the military, and one is interest on the debt. As Trump has already promised not to touch entitlement programs and to increase defense spending, where will Musk find these supposedly wasted trillions? Do some math and you'll see Trump's plans don't add up to anything good, said Timothy Noah in the New Republic. His tax cuts alone would add $10.5 trillion to the deficit over a decade. To pay for them and keep his spending promises, he'd have to scrap every federal agency except the Pentagon. Trump likely won't go that far, said Michael Ettlinger in the Boston Globe. Then again, he proposed the mass deportation of undocumented migrants who make up 15% of the construction workforce, 22% of farm workers, and 8% of service workers. Such a crackdown would vaporize the economy. We know what his other proposals would do too, said Robert Burgess in Bloomberg. His first term saw a whopping $8.5 trillion added to the national debt, while his tariffs damaged U.S. manufacturers. Voters may not have the figures at hand, but they know there's nothing new in Trump's plan. Worse than their wrongheadedness, politically speaking, may be the fact that they've just grown stale. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for dust busting. After an Indian college student set a new Guinness World Record by building the world's smallest vacuum cleaner, Tapala Nadamuni said faculty at his college called the device, fashioned from a ballpoint pen and measuring a quarter inch wide, the most beautiful creation they've ever seen. It was a good week for Earthlings. After the European Space Agency's Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer conducted a flyby of Earth and confirmed that, as expected, it has the right mix of gases to sustain biological life. It was a good week for scarfers. After New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu used the Heimlich maneuver to save a choking participant at a lobster roll eating contest. He went right back to the contest, said Sununu. He ate another 7 lobster rolls, right down the gullet. But it was a bad week for Donald Trump. After Taylor Swift announced on Instagram to her more than 280 million followers that I will be casting my vote for Kamala Harris in the election. In a dig at Trump running mate Senator J.D. Vance, the pop star signed the post as Childless Cat Lady. It's a bad week for team building. after an injured Colorado man was abandoned by coworkers on a mountain during a corporate retreat in the Rockies. Rescue workers who found the unnamed man next day predicted some awkward encounters at the office. Finally, it was a bad week for Yuletide magic. After Venezuelan strongman Nicolas Maduro, keen to distract Venezuelans from his rigging of July elections, ongoing crackdown, and the nation's economic collapse, decreed that Christmas will start October 1st this year in peace, joy, and security. And it's time for the briefing. Title this week, Dimming the Sun. As the globe sizzles, interest is growing in schemes to cool it through solar geoengineering. But at what risk? What is solar geoengineering? It's the concept of lowering the temperatures here on Earth by shading the planet. Scientists are studying several potential ways to reduce solar radiation, including launching huge sun shields into orbit and brightening clouds with salt water to make them more reflective. But the process drawing the most attention involves seeding the upper atmosphere with reflective particles such as sulfur dioxide, which would bounce sunlight back into space. The technology known as stratospheric aerosol injection is inspired by the planet cooling effects of volcanic eruptions. When Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines blew in 1991, it spewed nearly 20 million tons of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, lowering global temperatures by about 1 degree Fahrenheit for 15 months. Some estimates suggest a similar cooling effect could be achieved by using high altitude aircraft to spray 1 million tons of sulfur dioxide annually. That would cost tens of billions of dollars a year, far cheaper than the trillions of dollars needed to quickly decarbonize the economy. It's a radical plan, but one proponent say is necessary with planet warming emissions and global temperatures climbing ever higher. The idea of dialing down the temperature of the whole planet is horrifying, said David Archer, a climate scientist at the University of Chicago, but it's not as horrifying as dialing it up with carbon dioxide. Are any projects in the works? Most of the focus right now is on research. Which aerosolized particles might be the most effective, for example, and how deployment might be governed? The University of Chicago and Harvard University have programs focused on various types of geoengineering. The European Union and U.S. government are exploring ways to limit solar radiation. And tech billionaires, including Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, have pumped money into research. While most of these initiatives are proceeding cautiously, Make Sunsets, a U.S. startup that sells cooling credits, has over the past 2 years launched 82 weather balloons filled with sulfur dioxide into the upper atmosphere. Many supporters of solar geoengineering say small unregulated outfits like Make Sunsets are hurting the field. But some scientists say the entire concept of solar geoengineering is ethically questionable and potentially highly dangerous. Why are they opposed? Critics say it's a distraction from the core task of moving beyond fossil fuels, and that there could be unintended and devastating consequences to meddling with the climate. Large-scale stratospheric aerosol injection might weaken the summer monsoon, resulting in reduced rainfall in regions that are home to billions of people, notes Alan Robach, a climate scientist at Rutgers University. Other areas could see increased rainfall and an accompanying spike in infectious diseases such as malaria. A less intense sun could shrink crop yields. Then there are worries that if the spraying is stopped, the aerosols fall to earth and so need to be regularly replenished. Bottled up warming would be released in a sudden burst. Raymond Peer Humbert, an atmospheric physicist at the University of Oxford, said the planet could experience a potentially massive temperature rise over a decade, hitting the Earth's climate with something that it probably hasn't seen since the dinosaur-killing impactor. Even if that worst-case scenario doesn't occur, critics worry that solar geoengineering could fuel geopolitical tensions or even war. How could that happen? If one country tries to alter the climate to its benefit, other nations might suffer knock-on droughts or floods and could respond with military force to prevent further climatic harm. The White House and the Defense Department have both identified unilateral solar geoengineering as a political threat, and scientists and political analysts agree that international consensus will be needed on a host of difficult questions before any potential use. How much cooling is desirable? And how would disputes over negative impacts be adjudicated? But if nations can't even agree on curbing carbon emissions, how are we going to govern a technology that could purposefully alter planetary living conditions? Asked Elizabeth Chalecki, a political scientist at University of Nebraska, Omaha. Even small experiments with solar geoengineering have drawn controversy. Mexico banned the technology last year after Make Sunsets launched balloons without permission in Baja California. And a 2021 attempt by Harvard researchers to release a balloon carrying reflective calcium carbonate in Arctic Sweden was nixed after objection from the indigenous Sami people, who cited risks of catastrophic consequences. What do proponents say? They don't deny geoengineering could have some harmful consequences, but they say that those risks are being overblown and that we have an obligation to press ahead with further study because so little progress is being made in the wider battle against warming. Global carbon dioxide emissions hit a record 36 billion metric tons in 2023, which was the warmest year on record. Meanwhile, numerous climate tipping points are coming into view, including the thawing of permafrost and the drying out of the Amazon rainforest. Geoengineering, supporters argue, is a short-term fix that will give humanity the time it needs to kick its carbon habit. For Rutgers Robach, the question at this point is not whether hacking the atmosphere is risky, it's which is riskier, doing it or not doing it. And we'll read a few of the best columns. The first two come from the U.S. Defiling the graves of soldiers. For Donald Trump, defiling what is sacred in our civic culture borders on a pastime, said Michael Powell. But he really outdid himself when he recently filmed a campaign ad at Arlington National Cemetery on dead veterans' graves. At the invitation of two families of fallen veterans who support him, Trump visited Section 60, which is reserved for those killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. As he stood among the gravestones, Trump posed with his supporters, grinning and giving a thumbs up. Federal law expressly forbids taking campaign photos or videos at Arlington. When a female cemetery employee tried to stop the photography, Trump's campaign staff roughly pushed her away. Later, Trump advisors called her mentally ill and a despicable individual. Fearing retaliation from Trump supporters, the worker declined to press charges. The Army rebuked the Trump campaign for desecrating a national shrine, but said the matter was closed. It's not closed for Karen Meredith, whose only son was laid to rest in Section 60. To think that this man, she said of Trump, came here and put his thumb up. In even the most sacred of American places, Trump couldn't manage to comport himself with even the roughest facsimile of dignity. Biden owns Afghanistan debacle. Democrats insist that the catastrophically botched withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Afghanistan was all Donald Trump's fault, said Noah Rothman. As president, Trump did make an agreement with the Taliban to pull our troops out of the country in 2021. But the Democrats' exercise in blame shifting omits the crucial fact that Trump's Doha agreement did not create a plan for withdrawing forces, nor did it dictate the U.S. surrender of the Bagram Air Force Base, its 2,500 troops, and its secure runway before the withdrawal. It was Biden who came into office so hell-bent on withdrawing U.S. troops that he ignored warnings from multiple U.S. military officials that the Afghan government would quickly collapse. As one top military official said at the time, the president decided we're going to leave, and he's not listening to anybody. The resulting chaotic withdrawal from the public airport in Kabul on August 31, 2021, turned into a bloody humiliation, with a suicide bomber killing 13 Americans and dozens of Afghans, with thousands of U.S. citizens and Afghan allies left behind. Yes, Trump decided to withdraw, but Biden owns the national embarrassment that followed, which left an indelible stain on his legacy. This column comes from Sweden. Making room for the father of the bride. Progressive priests want the Church of Sweden to stop fathers from walking their daughters down the wedding aisle, said Susanna Bergerson. The bride handover, they claim, runs counter to Swedish values. In days of yore, Swedish brides and grooms traditionally walk to the altar together, starting married life side by side in an illustration of the fact that the marriage is entered into voluntarily between two consenting adults. But Crown Princess Victoria started a trend in 2010 when, inspired by Hollywood movies, she had her father, King Carl Gustaf, escort her in her wedding. Now fully a third of Swedish ceremonies begin the foreign way, with dad giving daughter away. Some female priests have asked for a ruling against this practice, saying the patriarchal symbolism undermines our tradition of equality. But that's ridiculous. It's not really a Swedish tradition to have female priests either, or same-sex weddings. But progressives eagerly adopted those changes without complaint. In any case, there was no equality of the sexes when Sweden's marriage customs were established. This whole debate is symptomatic of the fake pluralism of our time. Diversity in religious practice is to be embraced, unless one of those practices is conservative. And on to the last word, our in-depth article. Title this week, The Great Phone-Free Teen Challenge. I bribed a group of teenagers to part with their phones for a month. said Decca Aitkenhead in the Sunday Times magazine from the UK. Then I set them free to roam without adults. You've got to be joking. My 14-year-old son looked sick with panic. No way are my friends doing that. You can't. It was March, and I had just interviewed the New York University social psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his new book, The Anxious Generation. Its data shows rates of teenage depression, anxiety, and self-harm soaring, and Haidt blames social media and smartphones. To my son's horror, I devised an experiment. For 1 month, Jake, 14, and Jody, 13, would lock their smartphone in a K-safe time lock container, which could be set to release for just 1 hour a day. For the other 23 hours, they would use a light phone, a Wi-Fi-enabled device designed to allow calls, text, and group chats with an alarm, calculator, basic music player, directions, calendar, note, voice, memo, and nothing else. Black and white like a Kindle, it has no camera, though the most recent version now does. No apps, no Google, nothing. To make matters, as my son saw it, even worse, I would recruit 8 of their friends to join the experiment. What they didn't know yet was that it would include a wild weekend in the country. Recruiting my son's friends required interminable coaxing and ultimately financial incentive. Participants could choose to sell their light phone and K-safe containers on eBay after the experiment ended and pocket about £250, which is about $325. With varying degrees of dread, two boys aged 13 and 4 aged 14 eventually agreed. Recruiting girls proved puzzlingly difficult. They are the teens Haidt worries about the most, but the ones I see least. Whenever I'd ask my son why our house was only ever full of boys, they'd say girls were immature. The opposite was traditionally true, so I was confused. They're silly, they said, because they've been TikTokified. I didn't really know what they meant, but managed to recruit two who lived 50 miles away. As the boys only signed up for the merchandise, Haidt's theory that teens themselves feel tyrannized by their phones is already looking flawed by the time everyone gathers at my house in London to receive their light phone, K-safe, and copy of The Anxious Generation. As I interview them in pairs, my faith in the premise of the experiment wobbles only further. The vast majority of the boys' screen time consists of Snapchat, a hybrid app of messaging and social media, Spotify and YouTube clips of football and basketball games. Their content looks pretty innocuous, wholesome even. Several admit to wasting time on their phone, but only Elliot, 14, describes himself as addicted. All say they only occasionally post or comment on social media and feel no pressure to do so whatsoever. They are bewildered by girls' obsession with it. I start to think Haidt's critics might actually be right. They say teens are digital natives, fully in control, and Haidt is just a grumpy old man peddling the latest moral panic. Could he, I wonder, have overblown the problem? And then I talk to the girls. I have known Edie, 15, and Rose, 13, since they were at nursery with my sons. But I know almost nothing about their teenage lives and am completely unprepared for what they say. I ask how much time they spend on their phones. In unison, too long. Rose pulls out hers to show me. It is Saturday, and her week's screen time has reached 41 hours and 48 minutes, of which almost 32 hours were on social media. Both have Snapchat, Instagram, and TikTok, so they love social media. They look at me as if I must be mad. It's a trap, Edie says. You're stuck, because if you do escape, you're classed as a weirdo, and you'll fall behind on trends. You won't understand what people are talking about. Rose jumps in. But if you do watch TikTok, you're going to get influenced. You know it's all fake, but you still feel like it's real. You still can't help comparing yourself with everyone who looks pretty and feeling bad about yourself. And you're going to get addicted. It's literally like a drug. Edie deleted TikTok once because it steals all my time, and that makes me feel shit about myself. She ended up re-downloading the app, but then Rose adds, if you follow every trend, you get called a basic bitch, and if you don't, you're a weirdo. There's no escape, because your social popularity is totally linked to your social media. So if you don't post, you get made fun of. But then if you lip-sync to the wrong song on TikTok, you get made fun of for the rest of the year. When I asked why they signed up to the experiment, they looked surprised. Isn't it obvious? It gives us an excuse. We get to escape this trap for a whole month without looking weird. We can say we're doing it for the Sunday Times. Smartphones are only half of hate's explanation for the teen mental health crisis. The other culprit, curiously overlooked in all the media debate about his book, is the contemporary parenting culture of safetyism. Societal anxiety about safety has increasingly confined children indoors, denying them developmentally essential adventures. Safetyism having largely passed me by, my own sons have always had a lot of independence, so it doesn't occur to me to add an unsupervised adventure to the experiment until we are midway through. With clueless naivety, I therefore hatch a plan to offer the teens an unsupervised and smartphone-less camping trip in the countryside. The children, by now used to navigating the world without their devices, love the idea. I put the plan to the Sunday Times, and all hell breaks loose. It sounds like there is a lot that could go wrong, a manager emails. A campfire is a no-no. Another manager joins the thread. She wants the teens fitted with GPS trackers and shadowed by a qualified first aider, or safer still, for me to find someone whose children have already done this and interview them instead. What feels like 1,000 emails later, they are persuaded that it is not outlandishly dangerous for teenagers to take public transport unaccompanied, walk across some fields, and camp in someone's garden. Some of the teens are too young to go and others unavailable, but another, Dahlia, 14, heard about the experiment from Jake at school and asked to join 2 days after it began. And she, Albie, Isaac, Jake, Rose, and Lincoln, 14, start trying to organize their camping kit and bus timetables. Their approach to planning is less than military, and I began to wonder if the Sunday Times' concerns about their competence weren't entirely alarmist. After they set off in high spirits on Saturday, I discover they packed my car with all their camping kit so ineptly that the doors couldn't shut, and my battery is now dead. Taking only their light phones, they catch the tube to King's Cross, a train to Ashford, and a bus to a rural town, from where they have maps to follow a 2-mile country trail to my friend's house in a tiny village. Thanks to jumper cables, when they arrive, their gear is waiting for them to pitch camp in the large grounds. I am in the house, on call, but unless there's an emergency, won't see them until Sunday lunchtime. At noon on Sunday, campfire embers are still glowing in the heavy drizzle, so there clearly hasn't been a lot of sleep. Excitable chatter babbles out of the boys' big family tent. I peer inside to find Dahlia sitting in a large cardboard box, the other five snuggled in sleeping bags. The mood is electric. Talking over each other, oh my God, so much fun, so much fun. The fire was amazing. We got a ton of logs from the wood, and we made s'mores, and Isaac and Rose failed to play the guitar. We didn't fail, Rose is indignant. I played Radiohead. What was the best bit of the trip? All of it. Sleeping al fresco around the flames, even when the rain set in, made them feel, Lincoln said, alive. Obviously, it's horrible feeling cold and wet, but in your normal life, you do the same thing every day. So when you do something different, like sleeping outside, do you understand how great that feels? Only Albie packed a flashlight, but real darkness only intensified their fun. I loved playing manhunt in the dark, Dahlia chips in. The others tease her for having used her light phone. She's addicted to make a few calls and texts during the trip. Disconnection from home seems to have been another part of the buzz for the others. The biggest highlight of all was the discovery that spraying aerosol deodorant into the fire made it blaze like crazy. Isaac's eyes widened. That was brilliant. Simply eliminating adults, even something as familiar as camping, becomes thrilling. What difference, I ask, would it have made had I taken their tube, sat in another carriage on the train, and camped nearby in my own tent? Jake looks horrified. I would have hated it. Through clenched teeth, hated every single second. The greatest surprise comes when they dismantle the site. Although sleep-deprived and soggy, they operate like a well-oiled machine, packing my car with precision. In under 36 unsupervised hours, they appear to have grown up by about 2 years. When the experiment ends, my first question to the teens is, what would they have said about it in week one? Annoying, Albie says. Rowan would have said, this light phone is really boring. Elliot would have been fixated on waiting for his K-safe to unlock. What none would have said then, and one after another astonished me by saying now, is, thank you so much for including me in this. It was way better than I expected. I'm really glad I did it. Everyone struggled at first. But then, Lincoln says, you begin to notice things because you're not part of it. You start to see that whatever's going on your smartphone doesn't matter. You'll never say on your deathbed, I wish I'd spent more time on my phone. Elliot noticed that Snapchat streaks are completely pointless. They don't do anything, do they? Lincoln noticed that kids at his school had no idea how to have a meaningful conversation. Their attention spans are too short. Despite all this, every single teen would have hated to do the experiment alone. It would have felt like a punishment to Rowan, weird and isolating to Elliot. Although several don't sell their light phone or K-safe in the weeks following the experiment, they all find it hard not to slip back into old habits. Edie and Rose sound least enthusiastic by the end. The girls' relief when the month is over also suggests that social media's grip on them is vice-like. It's like an addict's behavior, Dahlia's mother says. Like, I've done the rehab, I proved I could do it, but now she's straight back on it. I was wrong about the experiment. I'd feared these teens were too emotionally resilient, too protected by conscientious parents from the worst of smartphones to prove anything. In fact, what I thought was its fundamental flaws was the opposite. If smartphones damaged only kids who watch self-harm videos and porn all day, all 11 teens and their parents would have told me I'd wasted their time. Instead, I wake up at night concerned, Dahlia's mother admits. The tech world is bigger than us. They are controlling our kids. If even these families feel defenseless, it's hard to see how a smartphone can be harmless for any child. Dahlia now feels vigilant about protecting her younger sister from social media, as does every older sibling. Edie and Rose's little sister has been begging her parents for a phone. But why would you give your child a phone, Rose fumes, if you realize how harmful it is? Just pressure and nicknames and labels and impossible standards. Why would you give your kids that? This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in the Sunday Times magazine. We'll read one of the technology articles. Free speech wars. X marks the spot. It takes a giant ego and plenty of courage to take on Elon Musk, said The Economist. And a Brazilian judge may have enough of both. Musk, the owner of X and SpaceX, may have met his match in Alexandre de Moraes, a Brazilian Supreme Court judge who has forced the world's richest man into a high-stakes standoff. Moraes ordered Twitter to take down accounts on X as part of an investigation into online misinformation from supporters of Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro. Musk, who has frequently aligned himself with the right-wing Bolsonaro, chose to thumb his nose at Moraes, who then banned X in Brazil at the end of August. When Musk dragged his feet on obeying Moraes' orders and blocking X on his own Starlink satellite internet service, Moraes, a man who likes and understands power, threatened to shut that down too, giving Musk a forceful signal that his management of X could affect his other companies. It's about time someone took this kind of action, because Musk is out of control, said Robert Reich in The Guardian. He is a worldwide threat to democracy. Having thrown his full support behind Donald Trump, Musk is happy to let Russia and other foreign agents use X to disrupt this year's presidential race. Repeatedly, Musk has prophesied a future civil war related to immigration and has posted at least 50 false election claims on his platform so far this year. The tech billionaire has long trumpeted his belief in the absolute importance of free speech, said Adrian Wooldridge in Bloomberg, but he undermines his arguments by peddling falsehoods that magnify social tensions. It's possible that the accounts targeted by Moraes were a genuine threat to democracy, said the Washington Post in an editorial. But the threat from one government official to ban X and limit the speech of 220 million people is greater. Overall, if you care about free speech, Musk is clearly in the right, said Katie Herzog in the Free Press. Still, that doesn't make him a hero. In the past, Musk has complied with governmental demands to censor content, including blocking a BBC documentary in India and censoring criticism of Turkey's president. Refusing to bend the knee to government censors would be more admirable if it applied across the board. Musk may not be the villain here, but what's happening in Brazil is a warning, said Marina Corin in The Atlantic. The tech titans' control of X and Starlink, the only internet provider for hundreds of remote communities in the Amazon, gives him unprecedented power. It's unsettling that in certain corners of the globe, one man is gaining the ability to determine who has access to the internet at all and what information they can find there. And on the talking points page, media, is the press sane-washing Trump? An unhinged Donald Trump vies for a second White House term. The press is failing America, said Parker Malloy in the New Republic. Faced with an incoherent candidate who has blamed wind power for the high price of bacon and insists that Latin American countries are sending legions of Hannibal Lecters across the border, the media routinely engages in sane washing, laundering Trump's insane rants to make him sound far more coherent than he actually is. They're failing to adequately convey the threat of a candidate who's vowing to wage a bloody campaign to deport millions of illegal migrants and impose long-term prison sentences on Democratic lawyers and election officials who work to ensure voting integrity. As Trump veers further off the rails, the dangerous disconnect between what this demagogue says and what's reported is widening. It isn't just poor journalism. It's a form of misinformation that poses a threat to democracy. Consider the coverage of Trump's recent address to the New York Economic Club, said Heather Digby Parton in Salon. Asked how he would address a crisis in affordable child care, he responded with a rambling, incoherent defense of imposing tariffs on foreign trade. The New York Times and some other news outlets paraphrased his response rather than simply printing his incomprehensible babble. Even worse was his truly demented declaration at a recent Moms for Liberty event that the public schools are performing transgender surgeries on children without their parents' consent. In major media reports on the event, this ridiculous claim wasn't even mentioned. If President Biden had said anything this detached from reality, cable news panels would be discussing how the 25th Amendment works, said Rex Hupke in USA Today. So where are the banner headlines and calls for the cognitively impaired 78-year-old Trump to step back? The left's griping about the media is overwrought, said Andrew Sullivan in his Substack newsletter. Trump has sounded nuts since his first run in 2016. So unlike Biden's rapid decline, it isn't news. To frame every news story with a narrative of Trump's mental illness is not and cannot be the job of the reporter. Perhaps not, said Margaret Sullivan in her Substack newsletter, but it's also not good journalism to provide false balance to avoid being accused of bias. If the media normalizes Trump's lunatic claims and authoritarian threats, it effectively becomes pro-Trump. Russia. Why it's paying MAGA messengers. It's 2016 deja vu all over again, said Chris Lehman in The Nation. The Justice Department last week exposed a sweeping plot by Russia to influence the U.S. presidential election and undermine democracy. The DOJ said it had seized 32 internet sites disguised as American news brands, peddling Russian propaganda as straight news reports. One headline on a spoofed Washington Post site read, "White House miscalculated. Conflict with Ukraine strengthens Russia." The Justice Department also charged a pair of Russian nationals, both employees of the state-run RT network, with covertly funneling $10 million to Nashville-based Tenet Media to produce Kremlin-friendly content. Most of that cash allegedly went to Tenet's stable of hardcore MAGA influencers, including YouTube stars Benny Johnson and Tim Pool. It's a reminder that Russian election interference on behalf of Donald Trump was never a hoax, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post. But now, instead of St. Petersburg bot farms, Moscow has Americans doing its dirty work. Americans should be informed of foreign efforts to mislead them, said Noah Rothman in National Review. But it's not just Russia. All of America's enemies are doing it. Iran was behind the recent hack of Donald Trump's campaign, and it has backed news-like websites aimed at undermining U.S. support for Israel. China has meddled in local elections, yet it serves democratic political objectives to focus solely on Russia. Anyway, the scheme did not deliver much bang for the ruble, said J.D. Tusile in Reason. The 2,000 videos on Tenet's now-shuttered YouTube channel clocked a mere 8,000 views each. And Poole, Johnson, and other contributors claimed they were duped in the Tenet scheme and that they were expressing views they'd always held. So Russia paid them to say things they were already saying to a small audience. Should we really be worried? Yes, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic, because this is likely only the tip of the iceberg. The Justice Department noted that a Kremlin-linked propaganda outfit had identified some 2,800 online influencers as potential mouthpieces for Moscow. We have a social media grifter class filled with easy targets for foreign recruitment, and a big slice of the American public that's eager to lap it up. Wild conspiracies and tune out legitimate news. The Russians have scads of money to exploit this weakness in our democracy, and plenty of Americans are despicable enough to take their cash. And a few of the short notes. The temperature in Phoenix has topped 100 degrees for more than 105 straight days this summer. The previous record was 76 straight days set in 1993. The city has reached 110 degrees at least 60 times this year, breaking last year's record of 55 times. In half of U.S. races for partisan offices in 2022, from U.S. Senator to members of local airport district boards, only a single candidate ran, according to an analysis of 29,400 U.S. races by three nonprofit groups. Democrats failed to field candidates in half of all races, a non-participation rate more than three times higher than that of Republicans. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from Barack Obama, quoted in the New York Times. He says, "At the end of the day, we're part of a long-running story. We just try to get our paragraph right." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.